I'm David Smith, and you're listening to the Faith in Teaching podcast from the Kaiser Institute for Christian Teaching and Learning at Calvin University. In this series, we'll be talking with researchers and educators who are working to understand how Christian faith affects teaching, learning, and the way we do education.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Education Forum. My name is Brian Bolt. I am the Dean of Education. Thank you for attending, and we're really excited today because this is a celebratory event. We're going to be talking about the release of a book, and this book is amazingly prophetic, given that we're in a pandemic, and we are practicing what I would call digital life together, and that happens to be the name of the book, Digital Life Together, The Challenge of Technology for Christian Schools. We're going to take a few minutes in a moment to introduce the authors of this text. And after we've done that, they're going to take a little bit of time to describe what's in the book. They will move around from one author to another, giving you different aspects, different ideas, different things that maybe have come up in the process of writing that book. And then at the end, we'll have an opportunity for you to do some question and answer. Before we get to those introductions, though, I would like to open with prayer. So if you would please join me in prayer. Father, we thank you for making this amazing and abundant world. We thank you for our lives and creating this world for us to enjoy and take care of and continue creating. We thank you for Calvin University and all that we've been able to do this fall. We thank you that we're still in classes. That's been an amazing thing. We all realize that there are people that are in trouble, people that are hurting right now, and we just pray for you to continue to be our healer, our comforter, our sustainer, our savior. We thank you for the gift of Jesus Christ, and we expressed our gratitude to you in this endeavor. Help us to live in that thankfulness. Thanks for your presence today. In Jesus' name, amen. Digital Life Together. There are four authors, and I'm going to introduce them, and you'll see each one of them, three live and one on video as we get going. Dr. David Smith, Professor David, is the director of the Kaiser Institute. He coordinates the DeVries Institute. He also is a faculty member for the undergraduate program, for the graduate program at Calvin. And when he has time, he writes books, and he writes a lot of them. So we're really excited about that. He also writes in journals, edits journals, speaks all over the world, and does so with a great deal of wit. He does speak in English, so watch out. The second author, Professor Kara Sevensma. Kara has been a professor at Calvin, formerly here, and we were sad to lose her, but in some ways we're excited to invite her back. Her scholarship really crosses a lot of areas. She examines special education and science education and literacy education, and yet she pulls them all together in this world of digital technology, which is really appropriate for the content of today. She especially looks out for at-risk students in this digital world, and we're excited to hear what she has to offer us. Right now, she's doing some adjunct work for both Appalachian State and for Calvin. Our third author is Professor Marge Terpstra. Many of you, if you're in the undergraduate or graduate program, you know Marge Terpstra. She's an associate professor. She is the chair currently of the education department. And that only begins to describe what Professor Terpstra does for undergraduate education, teacher preparation at Calvin. She spent time teaching in fourth grade. She has been a K-8 technology coordinator, which makes her perspective really important for this book. And finally, somebody invaded this WebEx meeting from Hope College. I don't know how we let them in. I'm yet to meet Steve McMullen. But he is an associate professor of economics at Hope College. We like those folks over there at Hope. The executive editor of the Journal of Faith and Economics. His research includes studies in education policy, And he is an author as well on this, in this book. I'm going to hand off now to Dr. David Smith, and he is going to start us some understanding of what's in this book.
So I'm going to begin just by a little about the inception of the book and decisions we made initially about what kinds of research methods to use in carrying out the project. This book started, I think, about 8 years ago in conversations with local educators, where it began to seem that a lot of Christian schools, like schools in general, were going through this period of very, very rapid technological change, adopting laptop programs, adopting iPad programs, students getting smartphones, and so on, and that the pace of change was going faster than our ability to articulate to one another what was changing and what difference it was making and what the consequences were going to be for the learning culture. And so schools that had spent decades talking about what made them a Christian school, suddenly within a couple of years were making these radical changes to the way that learning took place. And it was difficult to keep up with articulating how that related to the school's mission. So this project began at the Kaiser Institute for Christian Teaching and Learning. We were able to secure grant funding with the help of the Issachar Fund Initiative. And we pulled a team together that you see before you. And we decided very early that this was going to be a larger mixed methods study. Because, of course, the initial decision here is, if you want to find stuff out, if you want to find out what's actually happening with technology in Christian schools, how are you going to find out? Now, we actually used five different research methods with different ones of us specializing in different research methods, but we all drew on all of the data eventually. So we did online surveys. We surveyed teachers, students, alumni, parents in a cluster of schools multiple times across the period of the study with a developing set of questions. We had some initial questions. We added and modified questions as we learned more as we went along, so we created a body of statistical survey data. Alongside the surveys, we carried out 75 classroom observations where we turned up on the day of class without giving people notice so they couldn't give us their best lesson plan. And we turned up on the morning of and we observed 75 different teachers teaching a class, and we recorded everything that happened and coded it and analyzed it. We conducted 36 focus groups, plus a few more semi-official ones. So we spent actually quite a lot of hours sitting down with parents, teachers, students, administrators, and asking them to narrate to us what was happening in the school in relation to the themes that were coming out of other kinds of data. We combined that with six longitudinal case studies, where we chose six teachers who had been identified by their peers as being really good at teaching with technology and thoughtful about connecting it to a Christian educational framework, and we observed them for a longer period of time to sort of see how this might unfold across a unit of teaching rather than just an individual lesson. And finally, the artifact collection, I left this to last because I spent a lot of time on this stole a year of my life. We asked the schools for any documentary artifacts they had related to their technology programs, and they gave me a stack of DVDs, and I ended up with a little over 28,000 documents from the schools covering a 10-year period in their history that were related to decisions they'd made about technology, training sessions, minutes from board meetings, communications to parents, just basically everything that had been recorded on a hard drive that was in some way related to the technology program. Now, you can probably already tell that this generated an enormous number of data points, and this is why this turned into quite a large project. I mean, the grant was a little under $400,000. We spent about $75,000 of that on data management services. And there was just, by the time all of this is broken down and coded, there's just an enormous number of data points. But the benefit of doing it this way is you start to get a better chance of getting a textured sense of what's happening, because each of these different research methods has got limitations in what it can find out, even if you do it really, really well. So you can spend a lot of time in focus groups and get this really rich picture listening to people of what they believe is happening. But you can't tell from that whether they're really doing what they say they're doing. You might have to go into class and do classroom observations for that. And you also can't tell whether what the people in the focus group said is actually representative of what everyone in the school system would say. You need surveys to figure that out. And you also can't tell whether what the people in the focus groups are saying is representative of what they were saying 2 years ago You might need the artifact collection for that to go back and check whether the rhetoric has changed over time. And you could do this diving into any of these windows here and look at the limitations in relation to the others. The artifact collection, I actually had a lot of fun in the end. It was a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun being able to build a detailed picture of how the way the schools talked about technology had changed over a 10-year period and how the way they used Christian language had changed over a 10-year period, and to be able to track that story. But I can't tell from the artifact collection how many people actually read that document, or whether it really got used in a training meeting, or whether anybody paid attention and that actually affected the way teachers in general think, or whether it was just an administrator's great thoughts on a Friday afternoon. So the artifact collection on its own doesn't really tell me what was actually happening. It just gives me a trace of what was recorded. To find out what was actually happening, I'm going to need to talk to people in focus groups. We're going to need to do surveys. We're going to need to do classroom observations. So you can take any one of these methods. Each of them is specialized to tell you a certain kind of thing. It gives you a certain, hopefully if you do it well, that data is grounded in reality, but it's still only a particular kind of slice of reality. And the hope is that by combining multiple methods, you might be able to build a more realistic picture of what was actually happening by only relying on things that you can confirm from multiple data sources. So if you find something coming up in the focus groups that you really can't find a sniff of through any of the other methods, then you start to wonder whether it's just something that people felt like talking about on that afternoon, but maybe it's not a big part of what was happening. So this is what we spent several years of our lives sort of trying to sort out, was gathering all these different kinds of information and then actually trying to, you know, the first challenge was actually coding it all and developing this kind of enormous pile of pebbles, as it were. But then the next task is trying to make all the pebbles talk to each other and trying to create these maps of how the data from the different data sources might combine into a picture. So fascinating process, enormous number of hours coding and categorizing things and running queries in software, but lots of fun starting to see patterns emerge, which is where I'm going to hand over to Marge.
Thanks, David. So we thought it might be important just to give a little, pull the curtain back a little bit on at least one of those methods, because we see those and it looks nice and tidy and clean and just how we did all those five different methods and then we worked together. But I just like to look at the observations. So when we thought about doing the observations, we started, Kara Sevensma and I started with an observation tool that I and Professor Westbrook had used when we were in Zambia. And it was one that had been developed for an international setting. So we thought maybe we'll start with that. Well, it wasn't quite what we wanted. So we started tweaking it. And so on the left side of the screen there, you see this form that we started developing because we wanted to be able to say what's happening in the classroom, what kind of instructional strategy is the teacher using? Who's involved in it? Are there students and the teachers, or are they small group, large group? So we're trying to capture everything. When we got to a point of saying, okay, we think that we have a great little research tool that we can use to take notes on, we went very kindly and approached Professor Walcott and said, can we come and observe in your classroom and just try out our observation tool? And he granted us permission. And so we sat in the back and we were observing and we were writing and you could just see both of us. We had papers going everywhere and we knew that that wasn't going to work. So it's not a clean process, right? We kept working on clearing it a bit, clarifying exactly what needed to be on there. And then we had two other research assistants working with us. So then we had to work to the point of saying, if we're watching the same thing, are we recording the same piece? Getting that cross-researcher, losing that wonderful word, so that we are saying the same thing, right? That we are recording the same thing so that our data will make sense as we go along. So that just gives you a little picture there as to the tools we developed. Steve will talk later about the surveys as well. And David talked just a bit about the coding. But for each of these, we had to figure out how are we going to record what we're seeing, not just with video recordings or audio recordings, but in ways that we can parse it out and quantify, use quantitative and qualitative data. Then we came to the analysis part, and we have several shots of whiteboards where we were really trying to make sense of what are the major themes coming out here. What's really important? What are we hearing as we look in our observations and the surveys and across all of them? And so these, you'll see this is an early stab at it to say, all right, there's something important here about discipleship and foundation and formation, excuse me. And community seems really important, which is where that digital life together emerged because of that strong emphasis on community. And how does this school community live with technology and work with technology? So that gives just a little background to help you know a bit more of how our research happened and where how it came to be this book that we get to share with others. So we would like to just share some tidbits, things that stood out to us, some things that surprised us, or some things that we thought were important to share and that might be of interest to you as well. So I'm going to stop sharing and Steve is going to take over.
Thanks, Marge. Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Brian. It really is a pleasure to be talking with you all here today. I'm going to just give you a snapshot of a couple of the results that I like to share because there's a few questions that came up a lot when people found out that we were studying computers in schools. And these were concerns that were raised a lot by parents and teachers in particular and people in the community. And one of them was a question of screen time. Are these kids just staring at their screens too much, and is that good for them? And then we'll also talk a little bit about the problems with bad content on the internet and whether or not these kids are getting access to pornography or something of the sort. And both of these will give you, I think, a chance to take a look at how we were able to do a pretty good job of answering these questions that really are on people's minds when they start worrying about technology in schools. I should also note right away that I'm going to be drawing mostly on survey data here, but also initially on some of the data that comes out of the classroom observations. And all of this comes from a whole bunch of work at the Center for Social Research, where people just put many, many hours in helping us organize the data and, of course, field the surveys. Now, I'm going to talk about the organization of the surveys in a second. First of all, let's think of the screen time question. I've been talking to people about screen time a fair bit after writing the book because it's one of the first questions people ask is it healthy for folks to be looking at screens so much? Obviously, we do it a lot in this context, but we worry a little bit more about kids. And so what I'm showing you on your screen here right now are the amounts of time that we saw students using their screens in the random observations of the classrooms. And so Marge and Kara and others were in the classrooms and they were coding a whole bunch of different activities. And they coded when some of these activities were using a laptop or a tablet and when they weren't. And from that, we were able to estimate from our random observations how often the computers were actually being used. And we saw that we had about 2 hours a day in elementary school, about 2.5 hours a day in middle school, and close to 3 hours a day on average in high school. And that you can sort of extrapolate out. That's maybe half a day for a high school student, maybe a third of a day for an elementary school student. And that's over a lot of different activities. I think this was somewhat comforting for folks who might have worried that their kids were spending the whole days just staring at screens. So that's one small sort of sliver of kind of final results that we were able to pull out of those, out of the classroom observations. We could also compare this to the actual survey data. We asked students and parents and teachers over multiple years in different ways, how are you spending your time? How much time do you spend on different devices? We were able to compare students' responses. How often are they using their computer in school? How often are they using it out of school? To the same answers by parents, by teachers. We were able to compare between schools. And in the table I'm showing you here from the book, we're actually able to compare between two schools and also compare to a nationwide study that asked really similar questions. And we're able to see some differences. These students who have a one-to-one laptop program and they're given all of their homework or a lot of their homework on the computer, they do end up using computers more than someone in than an average person their age would. And we see overall that kids in modern Christian schools and Western Christian schools, which are names for the schools that we observe, we see them using technology overall, different screens a bit more. But their overall use of other kinds of technology seems a little bit less or similar to what we see students using overall. Now, I don't want you to think that these students are actually spending 7 hours outside of school looking at computers and smartphones and video games. Clearly, there's some overlap, as we note here. Every high school student in the country that I can that I've met is probably using their computer and their smartphone at the same time. And let's be honest, there might be a video game or a tablet, in action as well while they're doing their homework. I've got middle school kids. I know how it works. But this gives you a sense of the kind of magnitudes we got from the student response in the surveys and how we can use those surveys to answer these questions about screen time. Now, there's lots of other questions about screen time we could answer, but that gives you a taste of the data. Another sort of interesting question that we got repeatedly, particularly from parents in focus groups, was a real concern that giving all of these students access to the internet also meant that they were bringing pornography and violence into the schools. Now, administrators and teachers were able to talk about this as well, and generally parents seemed a lot more concerned than the teachers were, because I think it looked like the parents had kind of blown out of proportion how much of it was showing up in the school. Now, what we're able to do with our survey data is to ask in this anonymous survey how often students are actually seeking out inappropriate content. We asked this a bunch of different ways. We'll focus on pornography because I've got national survey data for that as well. And what we see is even when comparing to Christian teenagers, we see students in the school that we're observing seeking out pornography less than the national sample. So right on face, we can say at minimum, the one-to-one program isn't making this more of a problem, probably. Although, of course, we can't do a before and after because we weren't able to interview these students sort of with and without computers. So that's sort of a first glance piece of good news. We're also able to go a little bit further and compare between schools, though. So, for instance, we did survey data for two different Christian schools that were very similar. Both had one-to-one programs, but they had kind of different policies. So Modern Christian School was the school that we focused on. They used a filter to keep a whole bunch of stuff out of the internet that was going into the school. That only applied to the school network, of course. It didn't apply if someone had a Verizon account or something connected to their phone. But they also monitored everything that was going on the laptops that the students were given. So if a student decided to get into something that they shouldn't have gotten into, or even if they accidentally stumbled into, to the extent that that's possible, a pretty dark area of the internet, their computer would know that, and it would send a signal to an administrator who was then able to take appropriate action in terms of letting parents know and this kind of thing in other discipline. Now, this other school, West Christian School, they filtered their internet connection, but they didn't have that monitoring. They couldn't tell outside of the school how kids were using their laptops. Now, this afforded us a chance to do a neat comparison. We were able to look at the survey results from these two different schools and ask whether or not this additional monitoring seemed to actually impact students' behavior. And you can dig into the book for the details. But the short answer is it doesn't look like it made a big difference. The students at West Christian School responded with very similar answers to Modern Christian School in terms of how often they sought out objectionable content, how tempted they felt to seek out this content, whether or not they felt guilty about what they did online, all of these kinds of things. It was pretty similar. So it looked like the filtering might have had an impact, but we, of course, we don't know for sure. But the monitoring didn't seem to at least have a big impact. Now, there's lots of other things we could talk about, but these were questions that were, like I said, they were pressing for people in the community. And I think they're areas where we could give some real data and some comfort, even if in a limited way, to the schools and say this is what we observe going on with these kinds of questions. So with that, I'm gonna hand you all back to David.
You've been listening to the Faith in Teaching podcast from the Kaiser Institute for Christian Teaching and Learning at Calvin University. Learn more at www.pedagogy.net.